that they did it on their own terms, not mine. And except for the fact that Alec had cavalry pickets out there expressly to warn us if they tried something like this. Not only that, but those bastards' front is on this side of where some of those pickets were posted. So they didn't just keep Alex's troopers from spotting them. Somehow, they took out every single picket without anyone's firing a single shot or a single man getting away to warn us. Now that's bothersome. How did they manage that, sir? The same aide muttered behind him, and Garvar shrugged. I haven't the foggiest idea, Lieutenant, he admitted. And just between you and me, the fact that they did manage it without our catching even a sniff of what they were up to bothers me. On the other hand, all they've really accomplished is to shove their heads deeper into the noose for us. Not only that, but they're a good 1,000 or 1,500 yards this side of the woods. If Earl Winchair's cavalry can get into that gap, cut them off from retreat. The lieutenant was nodding now, his eyes intent, and Garvey discovered that the youngster's response actually made him feel a bit better, too. If the lieutenant thought what he was saying made sense, it probably did. Even better, other people might be thinking the same thoughts, instead of worrying about how the hell the Carizians had managed to magically move that many men that far forward without anyone happening to notice. That thought was still percolating through the back of his mind when he heard the faint, distant call of bugles. They weren't his bugles, and as he watched, the Carizian formation shivered, then stirred into motion. Now, that's an unpleasant sight, isn't it? Brigadier Kint Clareik murmured to himself. He and his staff had attached themselves to Colonel Johnston's headquarters group. Each of the two Carizian brigades had three of its battalions up in line, with the 4th battalion in reserve, and Johnston's 1/3 battalion formed the center of 3rd Brigade's line on the Carizian left. At the moment, Clareik had paused on a slight knoll, peering through his own spyglass over the heads of his advancing riflemen at the Coruscantian formation waiting for them. The Coruscantian lines were far denser than his own, deeper, bristling with pike heads. That tighter frontage and greater depth were going to provide them with much greater shock value if it came to a melee, but that possible advantage had been obtained by decreasing each Coruscantian battalion's maximum firepower. Or, rather, by decreasing it in comparison with the Carizian battalions. It looked as if Clareik might be about to find out whether or not his theories about firepower trumping shock power were going to turn out to have been accurate after all. Something fitting about that, he mused, as he swung his spyglass steadily, sweeping across the front of the enemy's position. It's only fair that the fellow who thought he was so clever when he worked it all out should get to test his own concepts under fire, as it were. Odd. Somehow I don't really find myself looking forward to the opportunity. I make it about 8,000 or 9,000 men, sir, a voice said quietly at his elbow. And he turned his head, quirking one eyebrow at Major Brian Lofton, his senior staff officer. In their main formation, I mean, Lofton added. Ah, yes, in their main formation, Clareik said dryly. Well, yes, sir. Lofton looked rather uncomfortable for a moment, then saw the glint of humor in his brigadier's eye. Somehow, Clareik said, the odds didn't seem so bad until just now. He grinned crookedly. I've just discovered that seeing all of those fellows standing over there sort of takes the concept of outnumbered out of the merely intellectual category. It does do that, sir, Lofton agreed. And look over there, in the center of their line. Clareik gazed in the indicated direction, and his mouth tightened ever so slightly. The terrain between the tangled wilderness through which they'd marched and the river some 6 or 7 miles farther west, consisted primarily of cotton silk fields, cropland, and pastures, with belts of orchards closer to the town nestled around the stone bridge. There were scattered sections of woodlot out there as well, although none of them seemed as choked with wire vine as the wilderness they'd slogged through to get here. At least some of the pastures were separated by carefully trained hedges of wire vine, and there were several stone walls as well. Fortunately, the walls were obviously intended as property markers rather than significant obstacles, and very few of them rose much higher than mid-thigh. Overall, it was as close to ideal terrain as he was likely to find. It did slope steadily uphill towards the feet of the Dark Hill Mountains. In fact, the foothills on the far side of the river were actually closer to low bluffs, he thought, and he had no doubt they were solidly manned by the additional troops the Coruscantian commander had declined to cram into his relatively limited battlefield. The river was too broad for smoothbore muskets atop those bluffs to dominate the lower, flatter eastern bank, although it would be quite a different matter for field artillery, even the carronade-style artillery the Coruscantians had developed. Aside from that, though, the ground in front of him was close to perfectly fitted to his own tactical needs, while the denser, deeper Coruscantian formations were going to find the relatively minor terrain obstacles much more hampering than his own men would. Unfortunately, the reason it was ideal for his riflemen was because the Coruscantians had been seeking exactly the same sort of clear fire zones for their artillery, and they'd placed no fewer than 30 or 40 field pieces at the center of their own front. That was what Lofton had spotted, and Clarake's mouth tightened a bit more as he contemplated what those guns would do to his own battalions if they got the chance.
"We'll just have to see that they don't get the chance, won't we, Kint?"
"Signal Major Brynden," he said. "I want our field guns and Lieutenant Hothim deployed in the center. Tell him he's not to come within 500 yards of their pieces with his own guns."
"Yes, sir."
Lofton scribbled busily in his notebook, then read back the brief message. Clarake listened, then nodded in satisfaction, and the youthful major went jogging across to the heliograph which shared the top of their knoll. The signalman manning the device read over the major's note, trained his sight on the mounted officers clustered around the 12-pounder field guns and their draft dragons, and reached for the lever on the heliograph side. A moment later, the shutters began to clatter as he flashed the instructions in coded flickers of mirrored sunlight. Lofton waited until Major Brynden's acknowledgement had been received. As it happened, there wasn't yet enough light on Brynden's position for him to use his own heliograph, but his signal party displayed the single green flag which indicated a message had been received and understood. It wasn't as good as having the text of the message repeated back to be sure it wasn't garbled, but if Brynden had been in any doubt about what he was supposed to do, his signalers would have displayed the red flag which requested that the message be repeated.
"Message acknowledged, sir," Lofton announced as he rejoined Clarake.
"Thank you, Bryan. I saw the flag myself." Lofton nodded, and then he and his brigadier stood side by side, watching as 4,000 Carizians marched steadily towards well over 10,000 Coruscantians.
"Sir, they're marching straight towards us!"
The young lieutenant, he couldn't be much over 19, Garvai thought, sounded aggrieved, almost indignant. And he also sounded puzzled, which, Garvai decided, could have been said of the lieutenant's commander as well.
"They couldn't have known how many men we had waiting for them," he told himself firmly. "Not when they advanced to their present positions last night, at least. On the other hand, unless they're blind, they can sure as hell tell we've got more than they do now." So why are they coming to us?
Corin Garvai would have given a great deal if he could have been positive the answer was Carizian arrogance or stupidity. Unfortunately, he doubted it was either of those.
Still, if they didn't expect to see this many of us, that could explain why they're as far forward as they are. And it could just be that having put themselves in a position where their only avenue of retreat is down a single narrow roadway, they figure their best chance is to hit us and hope we break rather than see their unit organization go straight to hell trying to wiggle away through that miserable rat hole of a road.
His chain of thought broke off as more bugles sounded. This time they were his, and he watched his own infantry begin rolling forward as planned. He scratched the tip of his nose reflectively, forcing his expression to remain calm, while a sudden, craven temptation to call his troops back ran through him.
"Don't be an idiot," he told himself sternly. "You're about to panic yourself into deciding to retreat before a single shot's even been fired. You're supposed to be attacking them, not waiting for them to attack you. Besides, if you can't take them with odds this heavily in your favor, what's the point of even trying?"
Brigadier Clarake nodded in something very like satisfaction as the Chisomians began to move forward. That massive artillery battery of theirs stayed put, not surprisingly. They'd put their guns in an almost perfect position, along the crest of a long, sharply rising slope. The artillerists had a wide open field of fire, well placed to fire over the heads of their own advancing infantry. Of course, there were downsides to that as well. For example, firing canister or grape shot over your own troops wasn't a very good idea. The pattern spread rapidly, vertically as well as laterally, which meant you tended to kill quite a few of your own men if you tried something like that. And the infantry, for some peculiar reason, didn't much care for that.
"Which probably explains why no one is advancing directly in front of their guns," Clarake told himself dryly. "I wonder if they've had decent artillery long enough to figure out about grazing fire."
His and Baron Seamount's own experiments had quickly demonstrated that field artillery firing solid projectiles was most effective when the ground was hard enough to produce ricochets, and the gunners had learned how to judge the strike of their shot in order to bounce it through an enemy formation. Grape shot and canister could benefit from the same effect, although they couldn't hope to match the effective range of round shot. In this instance, the ground was almost certainly too soft for good grazing fire, he reflected. Still, he would have liked to know whether or not the Chisomians had reached the same conclusions. Sooner or later, they were going to wind up fighting each other when the ground was hard enough. And it would be nice to not have it come as a surprise if the Coruscandians were prepared to bounce their shots into his men.
"Let's see," he thought. "I see lots of infantry out there in front of me. What I don't see is their cavalry. I wonder."
He gazed speculatively north, once again wishing that he had a decent mounted element of his own. If this Garvai was as good as he was supposed to be, and the fact that he'd produced this much fighting power in what had to seem like an ideal position on the basis of everything he knew about the Marines' weaponry certainly indicated that he was, then that cavalry had to be somewhere, and the most likely place for it to be was waiting where it ought to be able to cut off Clarake's retreat back into that blasted wilderness.
"We need another message, Bryon," he said.
"All right, I don't like this," Sir Charles Doyle muttered.
The Carizian artillery, despite the fact that it had only a dozen pieces, was angling across the developing battlefield straight towards his own 35 guns. That indicated either terminal stupidity, which, given what Karras had recently done to the navies of its various opponents, didn't seem particularly likely, or else that the gunners on the other side knew something he didn't, which seemed entirely too likely.
Maybe they're just counting on their greater range, he thought. We don't know how much greater it is, but if they stay more than 500 or 600 yards out, we won't be able to reach them effectively even with round shot. Not on ground this soft. And I'll bet you they've got a range closer to 1,000 or even 1,400 yards. This is going to be unpleasant.
Still, ultimately, the only function of the artillery on either side was to support the infantry, and the infantry battalions on both sides were continuing to march straight towards each other. Eventually, that was going to bring the Carizzians into Doyle's range, whatever their own artillery might be up to. And if he and Sir Corin's infantry could kill enough of their infantry, then their guns wouldn't be enough to stem the tide of disaster.
"Steady, steady, lads," Sergeant Whiston murmured,
even though all but two of the men of his platoon were well outside earshot. If he'd thought about it at all, he would have admitted it was really more of a supplication to whichever of the archangels might be listening than an admonition to his marines. The rest of the 3rd Brigade was advancing steadily behind him, through what struck him as a profoundly unnatural quiet. The pipes began to skirl, but even that seemed distant and far away. He could still hear distant bird calls and the hum and zing of insects buzzing about in the tall, almost ripe wheat in which he and his men lay concealed. He raised his head cautiously, lifting just the crown of his hat above the wheat. At the moment, that hat looked far less martial than it did on the parade ground, which didn't bother Edvard Whiston one little bit. The overwhelming majority of the scout snipers were farm boys, like Whiston himself. Most of them had hunted. Some, like the senior corporal of Whiston's own platoon, had probably supported themselves as poachers, in fact, and they understood how concealment worked. The handful of city boys who made it through the rigorous scout sniper training program had to learn that, and most of them thought it was funny as hell the first time they were ordered to attach random greenery to their hats. That amusement tended to disappear quickly, though, as soon as they discovered how simply breaking up the outline of a human head could make it disappear into background vegetation, which just went to show that even city boys could learn if their sergeants were prepared to kick them in the arse hard enough. He brushed that thought aside while he raised his eyes just high enough to see across the gently waving sea of wheat, then grunted in satisfaction. The Coruscantian infantry formations were moving forward as well, and he tried to tell himself he was glad to see it. He didn't quite manage to convince himself of that, though. Satisfied that the enemy was performing as hoped, yes. Glad to see several thousand armed men moving straight towards him, no.
"Oh, hold your water, Edvard," he told himself sternly. "And while you're doing that, check your priming."
Captain Anton Ilyin was young enough that excitement and anticipation almost overwhelmed his anxiety. Almost. His youthful self-image didn't like admitting that that qualifier applied, but given the sweatiness of his grip on his sword hilt and the queasiness stirring around in his belly, he couldn't very well deny it. Not that he intended to let any of his men see it. His battalion commander and his senior sergeant, at least, knew this was going to be his very first battle, and he rather hoped they'd kept that information to themselves. He'd been very careful not to tell anyone else that it wasn't, But he also hadn't gone out of his way to admit he'd never yet smelled powder smoke in actual combat. And he'd just as soon not have any of the members of his company figure it out at this particular moment. Somehow, he doubted the discovery would have contributed to their confidence in his leadership. He looked up as the sound of the Carisian bagpipes rose against the morning quiet. It still seemed distant, faint, like a backdrop behind the closer-to-hand swishing sound of thousands of boots behind him, moving through the waist-high, dew-slick wheat. Behind the muted clatter, jingle, and scrape of weapons, the distant shouts of command from his fellow officers and leather-lunged sergeants, and his own breathing. Morning sunlight was warm on his face, although rain clouds were gathering in the west behind him. It wasn't going to be as hot as yesterday, and he found himself suddenly hoping desperately that he'd be around to see the rain when it finally began to fall. He rested the flat of his drawn sword across his shoulder, as he'd seen his more experienced fellows doing, and concentrated on striding confidently. His breeches were already soaked from the morning's dew, and his lips quirked in sudden amusement. At least this way, no one's going to be able to tell it if I piss myself when the shooting starts. They were starting to get closer to the enemy, and he glanced back over his shoulder to check the major's position. He wasn't worried about dressing his own company's ranks. His sergeants knew their business far better than he did, and they would have resented the very suggestion that they needed his oversight to do their jobs properly. At the moment, his job, like that of every other company commander in the leading battalions, was to look confident as he walked straight towards the enemy with unquestioning assurance that his perfectly formed-up company was following on his heels. "It's a lot harder to do this when there are real people with real guns waiting for me," he reflected. "And they do have a lot of muskets. In fact, I don't see a single pike over there." His eyes narrowed as he realized he truly didn't see a single pike. Coruscant's new flintlock muskets had a much higher rate of fire than old-fashioned matchlocks, and he had no doubt the Carisians' weapons could fire at least as rapidly. Even so, it was unlikely musket fire alone would keep a determined enemy from closing, and if that happened, they were going to miss those pikes badly. But the Carisians had to know that at least as well as he did. So why? He forced himself to set that question aside, although the back of his mind suggested that he'd just seen one of the reasons there were no pikemen on the other side of the field. He glanced back at the major again, waiting for the signal. The distance between the opposing front lines had closed to little more than 500 yards. According to their orders, they were supposed to advance to 75 or 80 yards before firing. If their firepower proved as effective as everyone expected, or hoped at least, they would stay at that range and pound away until the Carisians broke. If it turned out that, for some reason, their fire wasn't as effective as expected, the pikemen would charge with the musketeers following in support. Since the Carisians were advancing towards them as well, it was up to the major to indicate exactly where and when he wanted his battalion halted, which was why Ilion was watching him, and, undoubtedly, why the major was watching the colonel, who had to decide where the entire regiment would halt. Sergeant Wistan's eyes narrowed as the Coruscantians continued to wade through the tall wheat towards him. It was odd. He'd felt more than a little nervous when Colonel Johnston had given him his orders and informed him that it was up to him, Sergeant Edvard Wistan, to decide when to fire the very first shot of the battle. Now that the moment was almost upon him, that particular nervousness had vanished. He couldn't say he missed it, but he did wish it could have taken all of his other nervousnesses with it. He had to admit the Coruscantians were maintaining almost perfect formation as they advanced. That wasn't easy, especially when the troops had to trample their way through wheat this high, and it didn't do much for the wheat fields in question either. The local farmers were going to be pissed off, he thought. The field behind the oncoming enemy had been trampled as flat as a pavement by thousands upon thousands of feet. One of the horse-drawn reapers couldn't have cut the unharvested wheat any shorter. Rabbits, hedge lizards, grass lizards, quail, and white-ringed field wyverns rustled and swarmed through the still-standing wheat, fleeing before those oncoming trampling feet, and Whiston felt a certain sympathy for them. He'd like to be fleeing too, if he was going to be honest about it, and he wondered what would happen when the wildlife running away from the Coruscantians ran into the wildlife running away from the Carizians. A large grass lizard, at least a foot and a half long, ran directly into Whiston's chest as the sergeant knelt in the wheat. The impact was enough to make the Marine grunt as the lizard bounced off him, and the already terrified creature gave a high-pitched squeak of panic. It landed with all 6 feet already churning and disappeared somewhere beyond him.
Well, that hurt, the sergeant reflected, not to mention almost making my heart stop, and I'm glad I took a leak before I settled in.
The thought made him snort, and he glanced back at the oncoming enemy. The lead Coruscantians were almost up to the farmer Scarecrow he'd moved last night to serve as a range marker. At an overall length of 64 inches, the scout sniper's weapons were a half foot shorter than the standard rifled musket of the line formations, although their barrels were only about 2 inches shorter, thanks to what someone from old Earth would have called the rifle's bullpup design. The shorter barrel's rifling also had a tighter twist, and the weapon was equipped with a peep sight, graduated out to 500 yards. In theory, a man should be able to shoot accurately out to 1,000 yards, but what with bullet drop, the difficulty in judging the range in the first place, and the sheer difficulty of picking out a target at such extended distances, it wasn't really a practical option for the majority of people. A single platoon of elite marksmen in each scout sniper company was equipped with rifles that were actually 16 inches longer than the standard infantry weapon, with flip-up aperture sights graduated all the way out to 1,200 yards. In the proper hands, that rifle could register a headshot at 500 yards and reliably hit man-sized targets at twice that range, assuming, of course, that the target cooperated by holding still. At the moment, however, those marksmen were all concentrated elsewhere, probably where the Coruscantian artillery had been emplaced. Wherever they were, they too were waiting for him. Now, as he watched one of the junior officers leading the Coruscantian battle line walk past the Scarecrow, he slowly and carefully cocked his rifle. The front rank of musketeers reached the Scarecrow and shouldered it aside, and Edvard Whiston raised his weapon, captured his sight picture, and squeezed the trigger. Captain Ilion heard the first shot. His head snapped up in astonishment. The closest Carizian was still at least 300 yards away. That thought flashed through his brain, but then he saw the powder smoke in the wheat field. It was to his left, and far closer than the main Carizian formations. But it's still 150 yards away from... Anton Ilion stopped thinking abruptly as another Carizian scout sniper squeezed his trigger, and a 50-caliber bullet punched straight through his breastplate. Sir Philip Miller stiffened as the pop-pop-pop of musket fire rippled across the front of his advancing regiment. Like Captain Ilion, he couldn't quite believe his own ears for the first heartbeat or so. The enemy was much too far away for either side to be shooting at the other. But then he, too, saw the smoke blossoming out among the tall wheat. There were dozens, scores, of the sudden white puffs, and his jaw muscles ridged as he realized what they were shooting at. Wistan felt a wave of mingled satisfaction and something like guilt as he watched his target collapse like a broken toy. Other scout snipers were firing, taking their cue from him, and all along the Coruscantian front, officers and standard-bearers were going down. The company commanders who'd been acting as living guidons for their men were the primary targets, and the deadly accurate rifle fire went through them like a reaper. As far as Wistan could tell, every single one of them was hit at least once, and behind them, unit standards toppled as other riflemen targeted their bearers. The entire enemy formation wavered in shock, but Wistan was no longer looking. He was too close to the Coruscantians to waste time admiring his own marksmanship or even that of his men. Even with paper cartridges instead of a powder horn, reloading a single-shot rifle took time, especially if a man was trying to do that while hiding in 3-foot wheat, which was why none of the scout snipers were even trying to do anything so foolish. Instead, they were busily scuttling towards the rear, much like the grass lizard, a corner of Wistan's brain reflected, while doing their dead-level best to stay completely concealed. Miller swore viciously as he realized the Carizians had just picked off at least half of his regiment's company commanders. He'd known every one of those officers personally, and most of them had been young enough to be his sons. Despite that, the rage he felt at seeing them deliberately shot down would have astonished him if he'd had time to really think about it. Officers had always been high-priority targets, after all. The only difference this time was that the Carizians had done it in a carefully coordinated, pre-planned ambush. The range was so great, and the accuracy of the executions, and that was what they had really been, cold-blooded, carefully planned executions, was so high that the men who'd carried them out must have been armed with rifles. And that meant the Carizians were fielding specially trained and equipped marksmen for the express purpose of ambushes just like this one. They couldn't have a great many of them, given rifles' slow rate of fire. No weapon whose tightly fitting ball had to be hammered down the barrel to force it into the rifling could possibly be fired as rapidly as a smoothbore. That was the reason no field commander could sacrifice that much firepower from his regular line units, no matter how accurate rifles might be. Unfortunately, that didn't mean the tactic couldn't be hellishly effective. And his jaw clenched as his immediate flash of fury receded just a bit, and he recognized what the loss of so many officers was going to mean for unit cohesion and morale. The steadiness of an infantry company, its ability to stand the pounding of combat without crumbling, was hugely dependent on its officers. On their knowledge of their human material, their awareness of who would be towers of strength and who would have to be watched carefully when the pressure came on, and perhaps even more, on the confidence of the men in their leadership. They knew their own officers. They listened for their voices in combat, read their own fate and the course of the battle in the tone in which orders were given. Now, what should have been a source of strength had been transformed into a source of weakness. And the men those dead and wounded officers had commanded would recognize, as well as Miller, that what had happened had been a deliberate, well-planned, brilliantly executed tactic, designed to do exactly what it had. Colonel Johnston's mouth stretched in a tight, teeth-bearing grin as the scout snipers decimated the other side's junior officers. Had he known the thoughts passing through Philip Miller's mind at that moment, he couldn't have disagreed with a single one of them.
It had been a deliberate assassination, and while Johnston was no more eager to kill people than the next man, he would have done it again in an instant. The Coruscandian's meticulously dressed lines were no longer as neat as they had been. Here and there, especially where some company commander had been miraculously missed, individual subunits had continued advancing at the same steady pace. Other units had stumbled to a halt as their commanding officers went down. Others had continued to move forward, but more slowly, almost hesitantly, as the men in the ranks waited for one of the company's platoon commanders to take over the unit. Unfortunately, quite a few of those platoon commanders had also become casualties. The portions of the line which had continued advancing halted abruptly when they realized so many of their compatriots had fallen behind. They stood where they were, waiting for the disorganized units to get themselves fully back under control, which happened, among other things, to give the scout snipers the time they needed to make good their withdrawal to their own lines. The camouflage-clad marksmen came filtering through the line company's ranks, sliding adroitly through the openings without impeding their comrades' steady advance. Here and there, someone took a hand from his own rifle to slap the returning snipers on the back, and Johnston himself nodded in greeting when Sergeant Major Salmon led Sergeant Wiston up to the command group.
"Good work, Sergeant. I'm glad to see you made it back in one piece."
The colonel gave Wiston's shoulder a congratulatory squeeze.
"And I believe you timed that just about perfectly, too."
"I hope so, sir."
The scout sniper sergeant shook his head, his expression grim.
"Begging your pardon, but I'd just as soon not be doing that again any time soon. Shooting rabbits and mountain lizards is one thing. This, though..."
"We can hope, Sergeant."
Johnston squeezed his shoulder again.
"We can hope."
Their eyes met for a moment, and then Johnston looked back at the steadily narrowing gap between the two forces and shook his head.
"Know that you've done your job so well, Sergeant. I suppose it's up to the rest of us to do ours."
Garvey was too far behind his advancing regiments to see what had happened. He'd seen the sudden white puffballs springing up out of the wheat fields like loathsome toadstools, and he'd realized instinctively that his troops had just encountered a screen of dispersed skirmishers. What he didn't realize was that there'd been over 400 of them, and that they'd just inflicted shattering damage on the command structure of altogether too many of his leading battalions. He was a little slower than Miller to realize the skirmishers in question must have been rifle-armed as well, mostly because his position, so far to the rear, made it hard to judge the range at which the shots had been fired, and even more so because he had no idea how devastatingly accurate they'd been. His mouth tightened as his entire formation halted, even if only briefly, to dress its ranks and try to reorganize around the loss of so many of its key cadre. Without any way of realizing how many officers and non-coms had just been eliminated, he didn't understand the pause. Surely a scattering of musket balls shouldn't have caused a battle line over 2 miles wide to stop in its tracks. It was a brief pause, but even small things could accumulate into an avalanche on a field of battle. He felt himself leaning forward, willing the solid lines and blocks of infantry to resume their movement. Priceless seconds dragged away into even more irreplaceable minutes, and still the lines stood in place. It looked as if his left wing was waiting for his right, and he gritted his teeth. Sir Ger Sumiers, the Baron of Barcor, was in command of his left. He was also the oldest of Garvey's senior officers. He'd been a soldier for the better part of 30 years, but he'd seen precious little serious action in those 3 decades. His campaigning had been mostly against brigands, aside from a couple of forays against rebellious Zebedians, not against trained soldiers, and he had a pronounced tendency to go by the book. Worse, he was still attached to the old book. He'd had more trouble than most getting his mind wrapped around the new concepts Garvai and his father had been introducing. Yet his firmly entrenched position in the army command structure, and in the political structure of Coruscant, had prevented Garvai from easing him out to pasture. At the moment, Garvai would cheerfully have shot him on the spot and hang the political consequences. All of his own pre-battle orders had stressed the necessity of getting to grips with the Carizians as rapidly as possible. Coordination was good, and confusion was to be avoided at all costs, but speed of execution was most important of all, and Barkor's right was firmly covered by Doyle's massive artillery battery. He didn't need to maintain perfect alignment with the Earl of Mancora on Garvai's right. And someone with all the experience Barkor was fond of mentioning damned well ought to be aware of the potential consequences of allowing a line of battle to lose momentum. Hector Bonnier, Earl Mancora, was half Barkor's age, with a military career less than half as long, but Mancora would never have made the mistake Barkor was busy making.
"But it's still only a pause, Corin," he reminded himself. "And each wing has 5,000 men in it. That's got to be more than the Carizians' total strength. So even if Barkor screws up, Mancora should still be able to do the job."
He told himself that with as much assurance as he could. Then his head snapped to the right as artillery began to thunder.
"Langhorne! I hadn't counted on their stopping that far out."
Sir Charles Doyle winced in dismay as the Carizian artillerists abruptly stopped and began unlimbering their pieces. He was reasonably, comfortably ensconced in the branches of a near oak tree, and he'd been watching their approach through his spyglass. He'd also been experiencing a deep sense of envy as he watched. Their gun carriages were significantly different from his own, proportionately more lightly constructed and with larger wheels. Nor had it occurred to anyone in Coruscant to incorporate what looked like a private ammunition wagon into each individual gun's equipment. Each gun appeared to be paired with a much larger ammunition wagon as well, but the bigger vehicles had been stopped well back, out of harm's way, while the guns continued to advance. The draft dragons weren't actually harnessed to the guns themselves at all. Instead, they were harnessed to the smaller, two-wheeled ammunition cart, and the gun was hooked in turn to the cart. Both vehicles together were little larger and more cumbersome than a single one of Doyle's own guns, and it reduced the number of draft animals the Carizians required to actually move the gun in and out of action by almost 50%. Not to mention the fact that everywhere the gun went, its own ammunition cart obviously went with it.
"If only Alec and his blasted cavalrymen had realized what they were seeing, this wouldn't have come as such a damn surprise."
Doyle had been scribbling notes to himself in pencil from the moment he first saw the Carizian equipment with his own eyes. Between notes, he'd concentrated on reminding himself that neither Windshare nor his troopers had any experience with true field artillery. Of course they hadn't realized what they were seeing. Why should they have?
And it wouldn't have made that much difference anyway. There wouldn't have been anything you could have done about it in the last 52 hours, even if they'd described every last detail to you.
That thought chased itself through the back corridors of his brain as the Carizians brought their pieces to battery. They went about the task with a polished efficiency, and the peculiar cart and carriage arrangement clearly speeded the evolution. Despite the fact that their guns' 6-foot barrels were almost twice as long as those of his own weapons, they had the guns fully deployed in little more than 2/3 of the time his own crews would have required. His jaw tightened as he contemplated the range at which they were doing that deploying. Without his glass, he would have been hard put to pick out individual limbs, but belts and packs were still visible, and the division between the Carizian's upper and lower bodies remained relatively clear. That put the range at more than 500 yards, but less than 7. In fact, it looked to be at least 600, although he might be being at least a little pessimistic. He hoped he was, at any rate, because 600 yards was right on the very limit of his stubby 26-pounder's effective range. In fact, it was outside that range. His gunners might just be able to reach them at maximum elevation, especially given his height advantage, but he wouldn't have cared to bet any substantial sums on the probability. And even if they could reach the Carizians, inaccurate would be a grossly inadequate description of their ability to actually hit them. The question, of course, was whether or not that would be true for the Carizians as well. Well out in the wheat field, invisible to Doyle among the 3-foot stalks, were the 30 men of Lieutenant Alan Hatham's specialized sniper platoon. The marksmen of that platoon were the elite shots of an elite outfit, and they knew it. Most platoons consisted of only 20 men, but the sniper platoon was divided into 15 two-man teams. Every man was a trained and deadly marksman, but normally only one of them was assigned the shooter's role while his partner used a spyglass to identify and pick out targets. Which was precisely what they had been doing for the last quarter of an hour or so. Doyle never heard the shots, nor was he looking in the right place to spot the rifle smoke. The snipers were actually beyond and to either side of the deploying Carizian artillery, which, by definition, meant they were far out of any range at which small arms fire could possibly threaten Doyle's guns. His gunners knew that as well as he did, and many of them had climbed up out of their gun pits, craning their necks to get a better view of what was going on to either side of them, which meant they were totally exposed when 15 rifles with 58-inch barrels, loaded with what an inhabitant of old Earth would have called spitzer-pointed bullets, specially formed in compression dies, fired practically as one. Doyle's eyes flared in astonishment as 11 of his men went down virtually simultaneously. 2 of them had obviously been hit at least twice, and his brain seemed to freeze for just an instant as it registered the fact that both of them had been officers, with the distinctive sashes and hats which indicated their rank. In fact, all but 2 of the casualties were officers, which meant that somehow musketeers he couldn't even see were picking individual targets with deadly precision. It took an instant or two for the unwounded gunners to realize death had just come striding through them. Then, as if a single hand had reached up and grabbed them by the ankles, they disappeared back into the protection of their gun pits, leaving 8 dead men and 3 wounded ones grotesquely sprawled behind them.
"Commence firing!"
Major Darren Brindon shouted on the heels of Lieutenant Hatham's sniper's volley. The one real drawback to the sniper's specialized weapons was that they were long and clumsy. That made it unlikely they would have time to reload before their targets took cover. So it was up to his men now, and a solid wall of smoke erupted as the 12 field guns of his 2 batteries bellowed. At 550 yards, they were a good 100 yards outside what would have been effective canister range for his 12-pounders. At 5 degrees of elevation, they could throw a solid shot almost 1,700 yards, but maximum canister range was no more than a quarter of that. Grape shot now, though, that was another matter entirely. Instead of the 30 one-inch diameter balls of a canister round, a stand of grape consisted of only 9 miniature round shot. But each of those shot was 2 inches in diameter and weighed almost 8 times as much as a ball of canister. and they could carry 550 yards quite handily from one of Baron Seamount's 12-pounders. Doyle was still trying to come to grips with the preposterous accuracy and range of the Carizian musketry when the enemy gun line vanished behind its own muzzle smoke and the first patterns of grapeshot came screaming into his position. Some of his subordinates had thought he was taking caution to the point of timidity when he'd insisted they dig proper gun pits. They'd known they had the Carizian guns outnumbered by a factor of almost 3-1, after all. But despite some grumbling, they'd carried out his orders, digging each gun into its own individual pit, so that its muzzle just cleared the shallow wall of spoil thrown up on the side towards the enemy by the excavator's spades. The Carizian sniper's brutally unexpected harvest had driven his uninjured personnel back into those pits in the instant before the 12-pounders fired, which meant Doyle's timidity had just saved quite a few of those subordinates' lives. For now, at least. The sound as the grapeshot came slashing in was like wind rushing through leaves. A sort of sibilant, many-voiced hissing that ended in the heavy thuds, like a vast fist punching the ground, of the shot plowing into their targets. Some of those targets were not the low earth berms protecting the gun pits, and fresh screams started. In actual fact, the Carizian gunner's accuracy was considerably less than pinpoint. Unlike a specialized sniper rifle, grapeshot was an inherently inaccurate projectile, and even for the longer-barreled Carizian guns, 550 yards was a stretch. But grapeshot also had the advantage of buckshot. Someone firing it didn't really need pinpoint accuracy to achieve lethal results. Most of the individual shot buried themselves harmlessly in the dirt. Of those which didn't, only two actually hit human beings. One man's head simply disappeared. The other jerked to his feet, screaming as he stared at the shattered, spurting ruin of his left arm. But horses and draft dragons were much larger targets than human beings, and Doyle realized instantly that he hadn't had them moved far enough to the rear when he deployed his own guns. At least half a dozen horses went down in the first salvo, most of them shrieking like tortured women at the sudden, unexpected agony they had absolutely no way to understand. The sound twisted a man's nerves like pincers, yet the dragons were worse. The high-pitched, agonized howl of a wounded dragon was indescribable. The whistling, ululating screams seemed to fill the universe, and injured beasts lunged frantically against their pickets. Doyle shoved his notepad into his pocket and came slithering down the tree in a shower of bark splinters. He hit the ground already running, charging into the battery's central gun pit.
"Draw the charges! Draw the charges!" he bellowed. "Load with round shot! Load with round shot, damn your eyes!"
Some of his surviving division officers and gun captains had already anticipated his instructions. He'd ordered his guns loaded with grapeshot because musketeers would have to come into his effective range if they were going to be any threat to his battery. Despite his own insistence on digging the guns in properly, he hadn't really expected the Carizians to embark upon an artillery duel, unsupported by infantry, when they had barely a third as many guns as he did. Grapeshot counter most active anti-infantry initiative any artillery's had. He'd never imagined that any infantry could have had, and he'd never imagined that any infantry in the world could engage effectively from outside grapeshot range. Now, even as he cursed and goaded his men into reloading, he made a mental note for the artillerist's manual he was still drafting. Rule number one, never load your weapons until you know, positively know, what type of ammunition is going to be required. "Oh, shit," he thought suddenly. "What the hell am I doing wasting time drawing charges? Why didn't I just order them to fire the damn grapeshot to clear the guns? Because, he realized, he was experiencing his own version of panic as he registered just how badly the Carizians outranged his own guns. That wasn't going to help anyone, and so he made himself pause and suck in a deep, steadying breath, even as the second and third salvos of grapeshot came hissing, whistling, and thudding into his position.
Slowed down, Charles. At least you've got the right idea, but slowed down. Good ideas are fine, but you've got to think long enough to make the right decisions as well.
Still more sniper bullets were hidden inside the artillery storm, and they continued to reap their own grim harvest from any man who exposed himself incautiously. Doyle couldn't pick the sniper's victims out of the general chaos, but he was harshly aware that he was losing men in steady twos and threes, despite the protection of their gun pits. One of the unseen bullets clipped the tip off the feathered officer's cockade on his own hat, and he started to duck down behind his gun pit's sheltering berm. He stopped himself barely in time, not because he was feeling especially heroic, but because of his awareness of his men's wavering morale. So, instead of withdrawing into cover like a sane man, he played the lunatic role his command responsibilities required of him. He took off his hat to examine the cropped cockade, then looked at the men around him and waved it over his head.
"All right, boys," he shouted. "They've gone and ruined my hat, and that's really pissed me off. I don't know if we can mark the bastards from here or not, but I damned well intend to find out. How about you?"
More than 30 of his gunners were down by now, at least half of them dead, but the others responded with echoes of his own fierce grin, and gun captains' hands rose as their crews finished extracting the charges of grape and reloading with round shot.
"Fire!"
Darren Brindon watched the sudden eruption of smoke from the Coruscantian guns. Its sheer volume was intimidating, and he held his breath as the 26-pound round shot sliced through the air towards him. Unfortunately for Charles Doyle's gunners, they simply didn't have the range to reach Brindon's guns. The round shot thudded into the earth well short of the Carizian officer's batteries, and he'd been right about how soft the ground was. The Coruscantian shot were the next best thing to 6 inches in diameter, but the rich, damp, well-watered topsoil was almost 4 feet deep, and it simply swallowed them down. Some of them plowed channels across the wheat fields before they finally stopped, and clods of dirt spattered outward. Yet not a man or a draft animal was even wounded, and Brindon smiled grimly.
"All right, let's put it to the bastards," he shouted.
Doyle jumped up onto the edge of the gun pit, exposing himself recklessly as he tried to see through the smoke of his own fire. Some small, very fast-moving object went by his right ear with a sizzling sound, and he realized that his new position went beyond anything that could be justified on the basis of encouraging his men. But he stayed where he was long enough for the breeze to roll away the battery smoke, and his jaw tightened painfully. So far as he could tell, not a single one of his shot had reached the enemy. He could see rips and gouges in the deep, even green of the wheat fields, which must have been left by his fire, but none of them even came close to the Carizians. He jumped back down into the gun pit, his heart like lead. His men were doing a better job of staying under cover while they served their weapons now. The slow learners were probably all already dead or wounded, but they had to expose themselves to work the guns. And because they did, they continued to go down in a bloody, brutal erosion of his strength, and they couldn't even reach the men killing them.
"It's time to withdraw," he thought,
astonished that he could have accepted defeat so rapidly, yet unable to think of any other alternative. I've got to get these guns out of here while I still have the animals to move them and the men to man them. Corin will just have to under...
His thoughts broke off abruptly in a stupendous, far louder explosion of musketry. Garvai's steeple perch let him see the entire panorama of his chosen battleground, but only until the clouds of smoke streaking the heavens started obscuring parts of it. Critical parts, he realized, as the opposing